Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics, one from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 311 for comics originally released on July 24th, 2013. Now, starting us off in DC is Larfleeze number 2. This had been the backup feature in Threshold. It's now, the fifth Lantern title out there. What'd you think of this one?
I liked it. I thought the first one was really, really great, issue number 1. It wasn't quite that good, but I really, really liked it. I liked the humor. The Stargrave character, I like him very much. He appeals to me. His sense of humor, it really jives with me very well. I enjoyed the sci-fi cosmic aspects of this, and like the art. There wasn't a lot of Larfleeze in it. You know, kind of less on him and more on kind of the Stargrave character. And
yeah,
that's probably by design, because he's better in small doses, maybe. But I really thought it was good, and I'm interested in the big story and the character that we get at the end. I'm interested to see what her angle is. I really like this book.
It was interesting. I agree. We didn't get as much Larfleeze as one might expect, but I think you're also right that a little bit goes a long way. He's a fun character, but if it had been 22 pages just with him as the focus, it might have gotten a little old.
Yeah, I think he seems to be a one-trick pony from what I read. He's very greedy, and everything's mine, and you can only do so much with that. So I think what they've done is they've fleshed out the Stargrave character and some of these other B characters and ancillary characters and support cast around to really make them really, really deep characters and much more with a lot to say.
What I find interesting is Pulsar Stargrave is a character that's been around for decades. This is a little bit of a different version of him. Are you familiar with him prior to the series at all?
Oh, no. I thought he was a brand new creation.
No. This is a new version, so in a certain extent, he is a brand new creation. He's apparently much more happy and acceptable being a butler than I would have expected from the previous version. The previous version was a villain of the Legion of Superheroes, and he was the 30th century version of the Kaluan Brainiac. Because pre-Crisis, Brainiac was from the planet Kalu, who's essentially they're green Vulcans. You know, very logical, very, you know, smart and stuff like that. Not really prone to either being butlers or quite the sense of humor that this character has. Or not quite the pointy ears either. That was very Vulcan, not very Kaluan. But it's a good use of his character here. Again, very different. But the hallmark of this issue, this series, is kind of that typical Giffen DeMatteis humor that was really epitomized so well and established so well back in the whole early Justice League days of the Bwahaha Justice League. And there are aspects here that are very reminiscent of that. Not quite as, I don't want to say over the top, but not quite as pronounced. I don't think they're making fun of the situation, but they're certainly having fun with the situation. This whole cosmic entity or whatever that we get here, I'm wondering, is he going to be kind of an ongoing threat, or is it just for this story arc? We get the name of one of his other relatives, of which there are 7 in total, including this guy. And I'm trying to remember where Kyle is having all of his stuff with Relic over in New Guardians, if this is related to that or not. If not, having what's going on here and what's going on in New Guardians is just similar enough story beat of a new cosmic alien from either a previous universe or an adjacent one sort of a thing. A little similar, but not in a bad way. They're very different stories, very different tones, very different styles.
Yeah, I did not know anything about the Stargrave character. I don't feel like I've lost out on anything. I felt I learned enough about him in issue 1 to care about his character pretty quickly, get on his side, root mm-hmm. for him, and then continue that right into issue 2, where I continue to root for him you know, want to see what he's that he's going to make it through, and it was kind of an interesting twist on why he is safe through this journey in issue two. It was an interesting twist, and I'm looking forward to finding out what happens in issue three when we get a little more of why that is.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I mean, this issue ends on a reveal that very much kind of attempts to answer, at least start to answer, a question they had explicitly asked a couple of pages earlier. And I didn't think the reveal really revealed all that much, but served as a great teaser for that next issue. And what a great way to end an issue with an actual reason and incentive to go back for the next. Wasn't a cheap cliffhanger. It wasn't, toying with us or whatever. It was a minor preview of what's to come. And that reveal also is another thing that sounds like it has connections to things that have gone before. And what's fun with the new 52 right now is, like you were saying, you got everything you needed to know about Pulsar Stargrave in these two issues. He was also in the backup feature in Threshold, and we got quite a bit of him there as to how he got kind of stuck with Larfleeze. The fact that the character shares the name and is from the same planet as the pre-crisis version, not even the pre-Flashpoint version, to me is a nice Easter egg, and I'm glad they're not just assuming people have that sort of a knowledge, because whenever writers do that, that's just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. Did DeMatteis also write, and Giffen write were they the team on Threshold?
I believe so.
So they've just kind of transferred over.
Yeah, okay. This is the first thing to graduate from a backup feature to a lead feature.
Okay.
In the new 52, at least that I recall. I don't think anything else has done that. If you haven't read those issues, the lead stuff with Amethyst was really good, and the backup feature with Larfleeze was really good.
Yeah.
Depending how many issues this runs, I would kind of expect them to collect those backup features whenever they collect this first arc.
And it ended on issue 7 or 8? Threshold did?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't think Larfleeze was the backup feature for the entire time. Matter of fact, I don't remember. It might have been, it might not have been. I thought it went for 6 issues there out of the 8.
Okay.
But I don't recall.
Yeah, I'd be interested in reading those.
They're fun. Basically, Larfleeze gets robbed, as he's a very possessive person. He's very much against that, and that kind of plays out for a bit. It was very entertaining, very much in the same kind of style and tone. How many of the other Green Lantern books are you reading these days?
Just Green Lantern.
Okay, all right. What I found with this issue is I found it very entertaining. I'm not going to say it was an amazingly deep story.
No, it wasn't.
But I wasn't really looking for that either.
Yeah.
And what got me was I think there are deeper, more involved stories in the other Green Lantern titles. I still felt this read much better, much more entertaining than Red Lanterns typically does. But I think a lot of that is Larfleeze is just a more dynamic and interesting, albeit potentially one-note character. The rage-filled Red Lanterns, that's very much kind of a one-note thing, too, in a much more downer, less entertaining, less humorous way. And that book tends to be so oversaturated with the reds in terms of the color and stuff that while I'm enjoying the story, I don't find it as entertaining or engrossing or easy to get into as I have for this.
And I didn't find that this was too orange.
No, not at all.
In its color palette. I didn't find that at all. And so they could have, usually the covers are quite orange, but, the interiors, I didn't find that they relied on orange that much, as a primary, color source. I thought it was well balanced.
I think the choice of a green skinned Kaluan helped, and just the diversity of colors. Yeah. I mean, the fact that it's not so monochromatic, helps a lot. I'm really curious with the next issue because the reveal they had here brings up a number of questions for me, going back again to some of the pre-crisis Legion of Superheroes stuff.
Yeah, this could open up a family feud aspect, Hatfields and McCoys type of storyline that could, you know, bring more family members in that it could be a long story arc with a lot of new characters coming in and play out over several issues.
What I like is it's planting seeds and not telegraphing the moves. You know, it's got, like you said, the 7 different characters, only one of which we see, another one we know the name of. A lot of room for expansion there. I'm hoping this is catching on and going to do well and be around for a while.
the little dog sidekick for the bad guy was also very entertaining. He was a great character.
He was, but there's the one part where he's introducing Pulsar to his new home,
mm-hmm.
and that's where they kind of, you know, introduce the question of, you know, hey, what's going on, that we kind of get a brief answer to. But at that point, the dog doesn't know what's going on. So
No. It
kind of begs the question as to, wait, why did he introduce him to the home that way? I don't want to give too much away.
I think I see what you're saying. I enjoyed their back and forth. They had good chemistry.
They did. But Again, that's a hallmark of Giffen DeMatteis writing. If you go back to, did you read any of the Justice League stuff?
You know, you mentioned the Bwahaha JLA last week as well, and I'm trying to think. I used to really like Justice League. And I cannot remember if they were the writers. I think they were. I didn't pay that much attention to creators back then.
This would have been Blue Beetle, Booster Gold, Fire, Ice, Batman was in there, Martian Manhunter.
Guy Gardner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think, that was when I was reading, and I love those.
It was great stuff. It was a definite change of pace from what the Justice League had been. Many people rebelled because, well, it's not the greatest of the great heroes or whatever. No, it wasn't, and that's part of what made it fun. And there were aspects of Elrond, who was the sidekick or whatever, to Despero, and actually at times to a few other people. So you have that leader, or that cosmic threat in their lackey, which is a pattern they were, you know, doing again here. Again, the implementation of it, the personalities are different, but it's something, the sort of thing we've seen before, and they execute it well here. It, like you said, the dog was a fun foil for for Pulsar, who is kind of, again, that butler, that second to Larfleeze. So drawing those parallels and having that you know, back and forth between those guys was fun and reminiscent of. So I think people who liked the old Justice League and that attitude, that sense of humor, should really check this title out, because I think it, I don't say it replicates it, but it's in the same spirit. I think it would satisfy a lot of the people who enjoyed that old sense of humor and stuff back in the day.
Yeah, it's a fun book. Was that about the same time that Justice League era of Justice League International, the launch?
Yes, it was. Okay. It started as six or seven issues of Justice League,
yep.
Then became Justice League International.
Yeah, I loved that stuff back then. I loved it. Yeah, and so if it's the same team, then no wonder I like this.
Yeah, yeah. And again, you should check out the backup feature in Threshold that kind of started this all off with the.
Oh, I'm gone to. I just really enjoyed this style of writing and this humor. So I'm definitely going to dig those up and read them. For me, this has got to be a solid 4, and I can't give it a 5. Just like what you said about it, it's really not a deep book. It's just kind of fun. So it's not quite a 5, but it's pretty close. It's a high 4 for me.
I can see that. For me, it was a very solid 4. I'm going to lean more towards the lower end of that spectrum than the higher end of the 4. For me, there were one or two places where there was a scene transition where suddenly it's 6 weeks later. I'm like, 6 weeks? Really? Why? It could have been just the next day and read just the same. So the fact they hammered that home, I'm assuming there was a reason we'll get later. And again, there was nothing wrong with this. I thought it was a very good book. They were just, to me, it was not in the realm of possibly getting the 5. Certainly, I think the first issue, though, was closer towards that.
Yeah, it would have been a 5.
Yeah. And this, out of the non-green Green Lantern books, in other words, between this and Red Lanterns, this, I think, could definitely supplant Red Lanterns as kind of the other book. I just think it's, frankly, a lot more entertaining.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
Yeah. Another Superior number one.
This is Superior Spider-Man Team-Up number one. This worked for me on a lot of levels. There were a couple of things where we got just a bunch of cameos from a ton of characters.
Yeah.
That was just a lot of fun.
Including one of my favorites, Moon Knight.
Ah. Well, I like seeing the Cloak and Dagger in their current incarnation.
I had never seen them like that. That's a new incarnation of Cloak and Dagger.
They swapped powers in Spider Island. Basically, Mr. Negative had inverted Dagger's power, and then to kind of save her, Cloak said, "Well, invert mine too." And he's like, "Okay." So Cloak is now Dagger. Dagger is now Cloak, or at least they have the powers of. I don't know. They never refer to each other by name, so just as the team name or whatever. It was fun to see them back. I was, frankly, expecting to see more of them in the issue than what little we got. But, you know, the cameo by Daredevil, by Gravity, I thought that was a lot of fun. Again, like you said, Moon Knight, Doctor Strange, they just had a ton of characters.
Sun Girl, Power Man, and Iron Fist. Yeah, we get a lot of cameo.
And again, great art here, too. What surprised me was, you know, at first I'm reading this and I hadn't read the Superior Spider-Man issue. But then when I hit that page where Cap's referring to that, it's like, well, okay, I better stop, dig that out, go read that. And I did. It's like, okay, that was cool. There are a couple of things there that, yeah, it really did put Spider-Man in a very different light, but also made a lot of sense from what we'd been reading before. Now, one thing, and maybe I'm just not paying a whole lot of attention, is this the first week between this issue and Superior Spider-Man that we've seen Spider-Man in this predominantly black costume?
Yes, and that's my one kind of downer about this issue is, when I read it, I thought maybe there was a point one issue or a half issue that I had missed. It almost seems like that we're getting a new costume and it hasn't been debuted anywhere.
Yeah, you know? I felt like I had missed something.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so it wasn't just me. I feel better.
No,
thank you.
No, I felt the same way.
I mean, I know I read a ton of comics, and I'll be honest, I forget some of the details on some of the stuff sometimes, but I think I would have remembered this. Because it's more or less the Alex Ross design that they had bounced around for one of the movies or whatever and opted not to use.
It's very sharp.
Yeah, it's cool. It's well done. What I loved about this, we get to really about halfway through the book before the Avengers show up, and they're the cover, you know, featured team up this time. Then a page or two later, we get kind of the turning point in the story. And I thought it was just a fascinating and brilliant way to deal with Spider-Man kind of being on probation with the Avengers. And it was something that I thought they played fair, yet didn't telegraph. So when they hit that point, you know, it totally kind of took me by surprise. I'm like, I see what's going on. It was a fun story moment. And the fact that I didn't see it coming is part of what made it play so well for me.
Yeah, I really like this. I love the cameos. I love the way it started off. The fact that the Avengers, you know, question this guy. What is he doing? What are his motives? And we get a really great payoff as the story progresses. And then, of course, the final reveal, which I cannot tell you, but it just opens up the possibilities that could be an episode in itself. What does that last page or so mean? For the coming issues of this book, it's exciting, and I didn't care for the Superior Carnage, and I really liked the Superior Foes the week before this. So this is, it seems to be every other Superior title is really good. So I'm enjoying this, and yeah, I thought the art was good too. But for me, it was the action, the story, was really, really solid.
Yeah, and the scope of it. Again, they pulled in a lot of characters, enough for them to be there, yet not necessarily take center stage. I thought this was a really strong launch for this title. It really kind of sold the idea of Spider-Man, who we know operates in New York and around all these different, you know, heroes and villains and so forth, but being kind of front and center within that community. And there is an aspect of the stories they're telling right now that they could not possibly have told without Otto being Spider-Man.
Exactly. And were you reading, well, of course you were, the last few issues of Avenging, when Otto came in, I think maybe it was started around 16.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed those, and this is the replacement for that, but I like this better. I don't know why, but it's just a different tone, a different level of action, and I think it's a step above Avenging.
He always felt like he was reacting in that title, whereas here, it's not like he necessarily planned all this out, but he came out really well, so he felt more proactive of Spider-Man here, essentially a more superior one. I'm, like I said, I'm really enjoying what the creative teams are doing with the character these days. Again, I know a lot of people got turned off by how Amazing Spider-Man 700 ended with Doc Ock taking over, but it has opened up so many story possibilities. It has just obliterated the whatever writing rules there might have been around Spider-Man.
They're missing out. They really are. If you turned your back on Spider-Man with the death of Peter Parker, you're really missing out on a great exploration of a different character that's still rooted in the universe, the same universe. I mean, you're really missing out. It's great. It's really great.
It's a completely different interpretation of what it is to be Spider-Man, both in terms of how Otto is being Spider-Man, but also how he is seen in light of how Peter was. So even though Peter is not in these issues, it's a very interesting exploration by contrast of his character. And I think it really is setting up a ton of story possibilities for the event of him, you know, coming back someday.
Yeah, and this does not seem like it's going to be like the Spidey team up of old, especially when the last page, you get a sense it's going in a different direction than your classic, this week I'm teaming up with character X. Next week I'll be teaming up with character Y and we'll fight crimes together. It's not going to be that. I think it's going to be something different. And yeah, I'm anxious to see what it is.
Well, and again, it goes back to reactive versus proactive. Both in Avenging Spider-Man and just the old Spider-Man days, he would just bump into somebody and they'd have an adventure. I'm getting the impression here that a lot of the interactions that this Spider-Man's going to have are going to be very intentional, very kind of with an agenda. Be it, you know, new characters or existing characters he interacts with. And it will have a fundamentally different tone than we've gotten in really any Spider-Man team-up book before. And to me, that's exciting. That's fun. I'm glad they're really leveraging this opportunity as well as they have been versus, you know, okay, he's Spider-Man for a story arc or two. Let's tell the expected stuff and let's revert. No, they're going with this. And I think it's paying off.
They're going like it's the only option, like there is no plan B, and that's what I love about it. They're doing this they're acting like it's without a net, and you know, yeah, they can always revert back to Peter Parker if they want to, but the way it's these stories are being told, they're not acting like at any time it could shift back. They're acting like the only world that they know is the world where Otto lived as Superior Spider-Man, and that's what we're stuck with, and that's what we're going to tell from now on, and I love that.
Well, they've gone all in here, more so than they ever did with the Clone Saga, with Ben Reilly having come back and replaced Spider-Man for a little bit. Yeah, the fact that they are owning this, I mean, we all know they're going to have a backdoor out of it eventually, probably, but they're not taking that as a given. They're not acting that way, and I really respect that, and I'm really enjoying it.
But it could be 100 issues.
Oh, easily.
It could be 100 issues. I no longer think it's going to be 24 issues or so. I think it's going to be much longer than that.
I frankly, I kind of hope it is on one hand.
I do.
Because it's great storytelling. But I'm also thinking we're going to be in the middle of reading one of these issues, and bam, when we least expect it, things change. Peter's back. It's a whole new game, and he's got to, you know, renegotiate his life or what have you. I don't know that they're going to, I mean, I hope they kind of really hit us out of the blue with that in a logical, believable way that makes sense.
Well, I you know, I jumped onto Spider-Man late after a long hiatus. So I came in at the 698, 699 area, mm-hmm. and then jumped onto Superior after that. And supposedly there were all the breadcrumbs you needed to put together what was going to happen, you know, 20, 30 issues before.
They say as far back as 600.
Yeah.
I wonder if
that's going to be the same. There's going to be these breadcrumbs and kernels that are left for us that'll lead up to the inevitable transformation or whatever that when Peter Parker comes back. I don't want to rush it. I really don't. I'm really loving this. So.
Well, I think they've planted those seeds. I don't want to rush them either, but I also don't want them to telegraph when Peter comes back.
Yeah, I don't either.
You know, I want it to feel like it's an organic part of the story, that it was the right time, it made sense, and boom, it just happened. You know, versus, okay, only so many more issues of Superior Spider-Man, Superior Spider-Man Team-Up, and, you know, 3 months from now, we're going to relaunch Amazing Spider-Man and Peter's back. It's like, no, no, don't tell us that, you know? Surprise us with the story and, you know, keep the quality level up. Because, again, what they're doing here is fundamentally different stories than they could tell before and sets up a series of stories they almost have to tell when and if Peter comes back, you know? His status quo has fundamentally changed. This whole he was on probation with the Avengers for a while and stuff. Going to come back in some way, shape, or form down the line.
Yeah, there's going to be a mess when and if he returns. And that'll play out with great stories as well.
Well, so there may not be a mess. He may make a mess when he comes back, because he may not be able to live up to some of what Otto's done. He's simply not as proactive. But whichever way they go, there's so many options.
Yeah.
To me, this has really re-energized the Spider-Man franchise a lot and changed the dynamics, I think, in some really good ways. They took a risk here. I think it's paid off. And, you know, I'm very happy with what's going on. To me, this was a very solid 4 out of 5, and a good way to launch this title.
Another high 4 out of 5 for me. Yeah, I loved it. I'm excited about the next issue of this, just like I'm excited about the next issue of Superior whenever it comes out. So it's great. It's great to have a nice companion piece like that. This is a monthly, right?
I believe so.
Yeah. So it'll seem like eons have passed before the next issue of this one comes out, as compared to when Superior comes out every couple of weeks. It'll just feel that way for me. But I have to hand it to these stories couldn't be written if it wasn't for Slott's vision on this. And I can't imagine sitting in the Marvel offices and trying to pitch this. You're going to do what now? I mean, can you imagine saying, you know, that I'm going to kill off our greatest character, replace him with his greatest villain, his greatest nemesis for the foreseeable future?
Well, this is all still under Steve Wacker as the editor, right?
I'm not sure.
Double check that, because he's one of the, it's the associate editor, Tom Brennan, Sana Amanat, senior editor, Steve Wacker.
Steve Wacker. Yeah. Alex Alonso is editor in chief.
Yeah.
Does that mean he's...
He's kind of in charge of the whole Marvel Universe.
Or does Joe Quesada have to sign off on the whole thing?
I think for this, they had to go all the way up the chain. Hell, they might have even had to go up to Buckley, the publisher.
Yeah.
But Wacker is the kind of he's one of the basically the stronger editors I think comics have these days. He's been around the block. He did the first part of 52, the weekly series. He's been on, you know, the Spider-Man stuff for ages. He knows storytelling. He knows how to rotate creative teams. He knows how to get the best out of them, and he knows how to get the handoff between them. Because when I was done reading this, I'm thinking, wow, Slott did an excellent job. And then I'm realizing, wait, Slott didn't write this. But it was the same voice, the same Spider-Man.
He inspired it, you know.
Totally.
These stories couldn't be told if it wasn't for him. And, and the other writers on the other Superior titles are going to benefit from what Slott's done and the bullets he's taken.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and it just shows how cohesive the whole overall Spider-Man creative team is across the different titles. It feels very cohesive, very unified, and they're taking some chances, and like I said, I think it's paying off.
Now, what else is in the Spider family? They stick Morbius in there, don't they? And what else?
I think they stick Morbius in there, certainly Venom,
yeah,
and Scarlet Spider.
Okay, and I've heard good things about Scarlet Spider, but I've never read one. And Morbius, I did read the issue that was it in 700? They gave a Morbius preview.
It was 699.1, maybe. It was around that time they did a 0.1 launching the Morbius stuff.
Yeah.
With Scarlet Spider, he's going to show up in the next month or so in some of the other stuff. He's going to cross over because it'll be the first time the Superior Spider-Man has met, Scarlet Spider.
He's also
Kane, who had been a clone of Peter.
But he's also going to be meeting Spider-Man 2099.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
And most likely Ultimate as well at some point because of the Rift. That's going to be crowded.
Yeah, more Spider-Mans than you could shake a stick at. But if they keep up the quality, hell, I don't care. They bring in Spider-Ham. Well, I might care at that point.
Yeah, shoehorn them all in there.
You know, again, they're telling fun stuff.
Solid.
So, shall we move over to our other book for the week?
Yeah, let's move on to Lazarus number 2.
Yeah, this is from Image. It's Rucka and Lark. When I got my shipment this last week, I noticed it wasn't in there. It's going to be in my next DCBS shipment. Occasionally, things get late by a week. But fortunately, I was able to get the press preview or whatever PDF format, so I read it that way. I enjoyed this, but I thought the first issue was a lot stronger than this issue. And I think part of that was the lack of any significant action in this issue. It was a lot of talking heads, more family politics. And it was interesting, but just not as visually exciting as the previous issue. What did you feel along those lines?
I thought the first issue did a really good job of introducing us to this world. Here's where you're at. This is what the world's become. And then issue 2 said, okay, now you need to know more. You need to know more about this world. You need to know more about this family. And we need to tell as much as we can. And yeah, it did seem a little, there was a lot of stuff going on in here with the family that we probably really needed to know. But it wasn't as kind of well-crafted as issue 1 for me. But I still enjoyed it because issue 1 did such a good job of inviting me in and saying, here's Forever. Here's what she's about. You don't know a lot about her family, but here's kind of what makes her tick. And now we know a little bit more about her family, and I want to know more. Because 1 set the table so well, I'm ready to go. Right through to the letters page, and the timeline that was embedded in the letters pages was great. Just really awesome fan service type of stuff to stick in there. I love the little touch about the family. The Carlyles they actually purchased Monsanto at one point, and if you've ever seen like Food Inc., the documentary on Big Food, you know what Monsanto does to food and how they, you know, the genetically modified stuff, and there's just so many layers going on in this book that I'm loving it, and I'm excited for where it's going to go.
I'll be honest, I didn't read the timeline part on the PDF. It's kind of a bright yellow against a white background that I hope looks better in print. So I didn't even pick up on that level of kind of the story and what they were doing there.
Oh, it's a great timeline that gives you even more exposition, more background on this family and how they got from A to Z. And it gives you a lot of information.
I guess the question I've got for you is, the first issue really sold me. Had this been the first issue, I don't know that I would have come back for more. What are your thoughts along those lines? If this had been how they launched it.
If issue 2 was issue number 1 and number 1 didn't exist?
Or they flipped the order or something. I mean, to me, this was so much less action, more plot. It actually reminded me of the Sword by the Luna Brothers. Because that was a series where once they really got the story going, there were issues that were very clear, we're moving the story along. Next issue was, we're going to have a really cool fight scene that's just a really great action piece. Next issue, let's move the story a little bit further. You know, and they kind of had the highs and the lows, and it was a good rhythm to get into.
Yeah, I don't think this would have been, if number 1 didn't exist, they wouldn't have launched with this issue. This issue 2 could only happen because of the way issue 1 set the table.
I totally agree with that. I guess my question is, I felt the two had very different levels of action and plot. And this was, like you said, a little bit more in-depth and stuff. And I'm wondering, are they going to kind of flip between the two? Which is more indicative of how the series is going to be? I mean, we'll know over time, obviously.
Yeah, and I don't see anything wrong with going back and forth. It may be reminiscent of, Walking Dead episodes where you'll get a great episode and then they'll kind of go on cruise control for an episode or two where not a lot happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more character development. And then they turn the spigot on and out come the zombies again. It might be something like that where it's action, exposition. And, it'd be great if it was well balanced. Each issue was well balanced with a little bit of both. But I enjoyed this enough that, I don't think it was a big drop off.
For me, it wasn't a big drop off so much as a different pacing, different tone, different style. And the way it left off made me think the next issue was going to potentially start with a lot of action.
Yeah.
It may not. Don't know. It's just, I was really impressed by the first issue. It was one of those I was trying out and it's like, yep, this gets on my list. Whereas this one, I was a lot more lukewarm on. I liked it, but in and of itself, if I had to make the decision based on this issue alone, I mean, obviously it wouldn't have existed without the previous. I get that. I don't know that this is enough to have gotten it on my list.
And I think that we're seeing that there's a few families with all this power. And then even within these families, there's some splintered divisions within each family. They all have their own little mini fiefdoms and territories, mm-hmm. and treat the people in their territories differently than others do. It seems like the matriarch is, or the patriarch, I'm sorry, the patriarch would be much more, he's a little more empathetic with the waste and what they're experiencing in this than the son was. The son treats them like waste, the one son anyway. And so it's a different dynamic just within its own family, let alone we haven't really seen any of the competing families very much, except for the marauding parties that tried to steal the seeds.
Well, and that was going to be the next thing I brought up, is we've gotten a lot, particularly in this issue, about the Carlyle family and stuff, but nothing about their adversaries, nothing to gauge them against at this point, at least not sufficiently.
Yeah, that, it's like a name drop, can't remember what their names were.
The Moray family, I think.
Moray family, yes.
And, you know, the way to judge I was going to say a hero, I don't know if that really applies here, but to judge the lead is by, again, who their opposition is. And again, they've only had two issues. Rucka's not the type to just thump, here's everything in the first issue, let's go with it. You know, he's telling a longer story here, and I respect that. And he's a great writer. And again, Lark's doing a great job on the art. So I'm confident sticking with it is the right choice. I was just a little surprised how won over I was by the first issue and comparatively lukewarm on the second.
And as this thing progresses, we get a reveal about just how Forever might have been created, and it's kind of icky. And we may get more of that later on, as the story goes along, exactly how she was created.
Expecting we're going to get some answers to that, probably not in this arc, but maybe the one after it or the one after that.
Yeah. It's kind of like the end of Chinatown, you know, my mother, my sister. I'm not really sure what exactly, what road we're going down, but it could be something creepy.
I think it's good for Rucka and Lark to be doing creator-owned stuff. I think they pick some good material here. I think it just needs a little bit of time to really get fully ramped up.
I'm ramped. I feel ramped.
You don't feel that we need to see some of their adversaries and the other families and
we'll get there.
I know we'll get there.
Yeah, I think we'll get there. And I'm
my point is we're not there yet.
Yeah.
I think we're still a few more issues before things really get into full gear. And there's nothing wrong about that. I think anything that starts in the middle of the action and just kind of assumes you know everything, that's a problem too. And going back to the sword as a comparison, it took a little bit for it to really get going full steam. But then when it did, it just kept going, and it was a consistently great series. I'm fairly confident this will get there too. You know, it's certainly got the creators to make that happen. So for me, 4 out of 5.
Well, that's good. I mean, the way you were talking, I thought you were going to come with a 3.
I was close to 1.
Yeah. Issue number 1 was definitely a 5 for me. This is, like you said, it is a step down. It's another high 4. I think I'm straight high 4s right across the board today.
As am I, actually.
Yeah, so.
One of those weeks.
That's a weird week. But it's only 2 issues in. Pick it up. I highly recommend it. It's get along for the ride for a little while and see if you're going to get where I'm at, or you're where John is, and you're just waiting for that next plot reveal that'll put you over the edge, because I think it's there already, and I'm ready to go.
I'm not looking so much for the plot reveal. Actually, I think I'm almost looking not for that.
Ah, more
because
action.
Because I thought we got a lot of reveals, a lot of information in this issue, but at the cost of any significant action. A lot of things were set up. I've got an idea of, you know, what's going to happen between certain characters soon. But it felt like this was a little bit more of the moving chess pieces kind of issue than I was expecting after the first. So to me, like I said, it's a 4. It was a lower 4. It was one of those I was debating between a 3 and a 4. You know, but it's great stuff. Again, you've got top-notch creators, so I expect good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely a solid book. An Image, doing pretty good stuff.
Yeah. So I am still behind on my reading. I've finished.
You didn't get those 100 read?
No. I got 1 week totally read. Got all the DC New 52 stuff read from the other 2 weeks, but I've still got most of the Marvel and the independent stuff. I just figured I wanted to read something else from this week than just what we reviewed. So,
what about you didn't get a Number Cruncher then?
I've got it. I haven't read it.
Let's table that one. I would like to talk to you about that one a little bit. Can we table that for another
episode? Yeah, certainly. I did read Chronos Commander or whatever it was, the other title by that publisher, by Titan.
Mm-hmm.
Liked it enough, I put the others on order because I had not pre-ordered them.
What did you think of Batman Superman number 2?
Mixed feelings. This definitely seems to be the meeting of these characters and their Earth 2 counterparts. The art in a lot of places just wasn't clicking with me. I think the story was good, but I felt Jay Lee's style, again, things were getting lost in the shadows, were more implied than drawn, or we got silhouettes. It's an art style that, while very good, not to my tastes.
Yeah, I think he's a strong artist, but it is a style. It's definitely a style. You're right about that. I didn't mind the art. It was a little less confused, I guess, than I was in issue 1.
Oh yeah, it definitely clarified the story.
Clarified some things for me. Until the Wonder Woman Lois thing towards the end, that was kind of, for me, that was came out of nowhere, and maybe I just don't know enough yet to know why that happened. So that kind of freaked me out a little bit. It was a solid ramp up from issue number 1 for me, enough for me to say I got to see what issue 3 is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I thought I was going to jump off.
I am curious where they're going to go, more after the first arc than during the first arc. I'm curious what the long-term kind of plan for this title is. I like this. I thought it was a clearer storytelling this issue than the first. But frankly, if I had to be cutting DC titles, it's a possibility I might have cut that one.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I don't, so I didn't.
Now, in your New 52, do you lump in the Superman Unchained Director's Cut?
I didn't get the Director's Cut.
Okay. That was really cool for me, just to flip through and see the Jim Lee art, the Scott Snyder script, and see how he communicates with his artists. And you got all the covers, all the variant covers included and everything. So it was a nice little package. $6, a little high, but it was still really cool to look at.
I'm enough of a process junkie that I considered it, but the price tag, the fact they solicited it only a month after, if it had been concurrent with, you know, it might have swayed me. If it had been after I'd seen the issue, that I could have then made the ordering decision, that might have tipped the scale. But yeah, I opted to pass on that.
Mm-hmm.
You reading the Trinity War stuff?
I did. I jumped in. I read the Justice League Dark.
How about Constantine?
No, I did not read that one.
That had some fun stuff.
That was him and who went off? They went off together?
Shazam.
Yeah, he and Shazam went off on a little side quest.
And I enjoyed that quite a bit. I think I like that a little bit more than the main Trinity War story itself so far. I'm enjoying it, but I prefer my heroes to fight crime, not each other.
Yeah.
So there's a certain aspect of the premise that just kind of rubs me a little bit the wrong way. But that was another one where I think I was starting to read, I was starting to read Constantine, and it said, hey, this takes place, you know, in the middle of this. It's like, okay, fine, let me put this down, let me go get the other comic, read that. I had that a time or two this week, but, you know, hey, I'll live.
So, Dark Knight 22, Batman mm-hmm. Dark Knight 22, this is a Greg Hurwitz book, who I believe is going to take over Detective, is that right?
It could be,
I think they're bouncing John Layman already. Which, you know, the books have been pretty uneven, so I can't blame them, but I'm not sure if Dark Knight is a much stronger title, and to put him on the book, it's questionable in my mind.
Yeah.
I don't have a citation for this. This is a rumor I've heard.
Okay, I'm actually pulling out the previews now and kind of flipping through it to see what it says. It's still got Hurwitz on Dark Knight, and Layman still on Detective. So
yeah.
I don't know. Usually, unless a book, mainstream Marvel or DC, is kind of in that questionable category for me, I usually don't pay a whole lot of attention as to who they announce is going to write what, because I figure I'm already getting it.
When you're all in, you have that luxury.
Yes. Yes, I do. But it also makes it a little harder to keep track of now who's writing the good stuff again, because I'm reading a lot of stuff. But I'm liking Dark Knight. The story they're telling and stuff is fun.
Now, the Catwoman 22 kind of explored this underground, this Gotham underground that I had never seen before, with a Dr. Phosphorus, who I'd never heard of.
He's been around before. The underground has not, at least not in this way. It seemed pretty big.
It seems like a pretty big deal, yeah.
Dr. Phosphorus has been around since, I think, the 70s. If you ever watched the Batman Beyond animated series, one of the bad guys for him, I think it was Blight, maybe, was kind of sort of based on Dr. Phosphorus.
Okay.
So, I mean, some of what they're doing in the Catwoman stuff with the different gangs and stuff, I don't know is the direction I would have gone. The tech person and stuff I thought was fun. I thought that added a nice aspect to the character, but the whole underground thing, it was a little hard for me to swallow that all that stuff had been, you know, under Gotham and, like, nobody had ever really noticed or something.
Yeah, and the fight between Dr. Phosphorus and Catwoman seemed to end kind of oddly. Okay, I give up. Okay, well, it was just a test anyway. And now you're in. That was kind of strange. It didn't seem like it was part of the, it should have been part of the story. It kind of hit a wall there.
I don't think Catwoman is at the peak of the character's, publication history at this point. Not at a depth either, but I think it's had other runs that were much stronger and better than what I feel we're getting so far.
Right. Did you say you had read some of the Marvel stuff as well, or just?
Not from this week.
Okay, so no Hawkeye.
Not yet.
It was very good. Nice oversized issue, oversized price. $5 from $2.99. That's quite a jump, I thought.
Well, for an annual, it makes sense, though.
Yeah, yeah. It didn't get a lot more pages, though.
Yeah.
You know. But it was very Kate Bishop focused, and I enjoyed it. I like her character, and so it was cool to see a little bit more. Issues 4 and 5 of Hawkeye were drawn by Polito,
mm-hmm.
and that's who drew this annual. And it was a kind of almost a continuation of that issue 4 and 5. So that was really kind of a cool touch, you know, to get that all that synergy and almost like the third arc in that storyline.
Cool.
It was really good. Superior Spider-Man, when you haven't read that yet either.
No, that one I had read because it was referenced in the team-up.
Oh, you did read Superior.
Yeah, so when they brought in the Arachnots and the Spiderlings, I'm like, yeah, this is a very different Spider-Man.
This is a very different Spider-Man. And this one, more so than the team-up, I felt, did I miss an issue? Because he's got henchmen? He's got an army? He's got...
At the end of what we read the previous week, when they resolved the whole bit with the raft,
yeah,
he winds up with more resources.
Yeah, but I would have thought you could have taken a beat, half an issue, and...
They took an issue break. They set stuff up last issue, and it paid off really quick.
Yeah, it sure did.
Yeah.
It sure did. It was great, you know? There was a problem in Hell's Kitchen, and Superior's going to take care of it. And that's that.
I am amazed how proactive this Spider-Man is. And it's fun because, like I said, it changes the rules.
And then after this great story, this great, you know, this battle, we get this new tech, we get this army. Spider-Man's got henchmen, for criminy's sake. I mean, he's got henchmen. How cool is that? That's just a cool touch. And after all of this, then we get another little glimpse of Green Goblin. And we think, okay, that's not, we haven't forgot about that yet. It's still
they're building a lot of stuff up in the Spider-Man titles right now. And at some point it's going to come to an explosive, you know, point. And they're setting up so much great, they're telling great stories and they're setting up great stories. It's just one of those where they keep like priming the pump. It's amazing. Superior.
And we're just getting just a little bit about Green Goblin here. You know, a few issues ago, we got just a panel. Oh, we just get another panel a couple of issues after that. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting another couple panels, but it's just enough to say, oh, we haven't forgotten. It's coming.
What I like is it never feels like they're pausing the main story for a one-page, you know, aside or interlude or, you know, whatever for something else. It's part and parcel of the story they're telling, and they're just revealing a little, planting a few seeds, growing some story arc, you know, plot lines or whatever. Because there have been other titles in the past where when they would do that kind of a stuff, it's here's the main story, whoop, stop, pause, let's tell this other little unrelated thing. Okay, now back to the main story. And they're not doing that here. It's a lot of fun. And again, I as much as I credit Slott and the other creators, I do think Steve Wacker deserves some of the credit for this too. You know, they know what stories they're going to tell later, and they set those up properly.
And it's back to J. Jonah Jameson and Spider-Man being at odds. I didn't like that, them getting along so well earlier on. And it's nice to see that he's pulling his hair out again. You know, he's driving him crazy. He's got him over a barrel, but it's a different dynamic than they had before, back in the Peter Parker era, but it's still at odds. And
it's
that's
one
where it belongs.
That should Peter ever come back can play out in two very different ways. Either Jonah realizes it was a different Spider-Man, you know, or he doesn't, and the ramifications thereof. I mean, it's something that, I think is setting up long-term story potential without being too specific as to what stories they have to tell, but there should be ramifications of this down the line when Peter comes back.
Yeah.
You know, I think while, like you said, I can't imagine how they pitched this and how they got it approved to do all of this stuff, but it was a really smart move. I think it's really paid off.
Yeah, just another great Spidey issue, and I don't think I've really not liked any of them, so I might be a little biased. I've enjoyed the majority of the Spider-Man books, and this is just another in the line.
I think they've been getting really good buzz, and deservedly so. You know, I understand, again, people being really turned off by it's not Peter, and it's not, and that's part of what's making it work. I think people who are actually going into the material with a bit more of an open mind, by and large, are really enjoying it. So you tell good stories, it works out.
Yeah.
So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I have one thing that's bugging me, and that's okay. Wolverine and the X-Men number 33.
Okay, haven't read it yet, but all right.
I know, and this really won't ruin it for you, but, you know, I just jumped on this in 29 when we reviewed, I believe, that issue, and I've really been enjoying this title. And they have a character on there that they introduce, and she's 14 years old. She's introduced as 14 years old, and then they make her into this sexy, something that a 14-year-old should not look like. And
I think they have to do this. I think there are some artists that somehow have never seen young kids, despite having presumably been one at one time.
It just amazes me. I mean, have they not read any of the research? The average age of a comic book reader is not, it cannot be, in their teens. I mean,
not unless teens are getting a hell of a lot bigger allowance than they used to.
They need, why are they making their characters this young? There is no reason for it. Make them all 18 at least. We don't need any team. You know, you can have your green team. You can have your green teams, and you can have your all ages books. But your mainstream 616 and New 52 books, you know, for your comic book reader, your sweet spot, make your characters 18.
I don't know that I would go as high as 18. I could see certainly a case for 16. I mean, the theory is that you become a mutant at puberty. So I don't know it. I think given that this is a school for young mutants, younger characters make a lot of sense and open up some story potentials that older characters, even, you know, 18, 19 or whatever, wouldn't really facilitate as well.
Well, let's not age them then. Let's not name their age.
That's
let's,
fair.
Let the reader assume how old they are.
Well,
and not actually spell out that that this girl is 14, and now let's over sexualize her, and let's make her into this strap on this outfit on her, and now she's a 14-year-old girl that doesn't look like any 14-year-old girl in the world.
Yeah, if you're gonna define the character as that age, treat him respectfully at that age. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The over sexualizing of any character, I think, is a bad thing. It kind of reminds me of when Jamal Igel was on Supergirl and made some subtle changes to her costume just to reflect the fact that, you know, maybe younger girls are reading this and seeing her as a role model. Let's have her dress a little bit more appropriately.
Well, World's Finest, I enjoy Power Girl's outfits. I'm not going to lie. You know, I'm glad that she's
also not portrayed.
Yes, she's a woman.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's always been an aspect of that character.
And she loses the costume or gets torn pretty much every issue. So, I mean, that's okay because she's a grown woman. And I'm off my soapbox now, but that just drove me crazy and took me completely out of the story, made me mad. I shouldn't be mad while I'm reading a comic.
I can understand that. I'll see if I pick up on that when I read it and stuff. But
yeah, it might just be me.
No, well, it's one of those things that they're telling mass entertainment. There's a certain responsibility that does come with that, and you know, be it over sexualizing or doing other things that make people feel, you know, uncomfortable with their body image or whatever. That who does that help? You know, it's a little different in comics than like on TV or whatever. But I mean, how many of the superheroes do you see out there in comics that are either balding, overweight, or otherwise something that you wouldn't see on a magazine cover as a,
right,
you know, a model of some sort?
And yeah, I'm not asking for that, but I do think if with the mutant angle and the fact that it's onset on puberty, that's fine. I just don't think you need to state it overtly that this is a 14. I mean, 14 is just ridiculously young,
yeah,
for a character read by the average age of a comic book reader is what, 29, 30, something like that?
Don't know, but that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, so I don't know. Makes no sense.
Yeah.
Now I'm done.
All right. Cool. Join us next week for Collider number 1 from DC, Guardians of the Galaxy number 5 from Marvel, and Three Guns number 1 from Boom Studios. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.